I'm reminded of George Whitefield in the Great Awakening in the 1740s. Having gone to law school in the Boston area, I'd go across Boston Common almost every day, and I would go across, and I'd think, you know, in 1740, Whitefield preached on this spot to 30,000 people when the population was maybe 10,000 of Boston, without voice amplification. And yet so power was his oratory that on one occasion he knocked a 10-year-old boy out of the branch of a tree a quarter of a mile away. We know that this happened because it was young Benjamin Franklin who later wrote about it in autobiography. And he said, Whitefield, so great was his power of elocution that he could bring a penitent heart to tears simply by uttering the word Mesopotamia. So, I mean, I think of George Whitefield. I got to have a microphone here in this room. Come on, give me a break. If you can't hear it, it'll be on my website by the end of the week. Here's these awesome kids. Do you see these kids come in?
Yeah.
Let's hear it for them. Yeah. I've been teaching almost 25 years, fourth graders, and this is my current crop of students. And I tell these kids every week at the end of class, what do I tell you? That's right. You're awesome, and you're going to change the world. And I've done this for many years now, and I see some kids that are 10, 15 years out of my class that are changing the world now. And I've had a lot of your kids in the class, and it's been my privilege and pleasure to teach. Well, okay, let's get started with our lesson for today. If you have any questions, just raise your hand, and we'll deal with those. But Roger asked me to speak today, and this is kind of an annual update, isn't it, on astronomy, where we cover some topics that are kind of current in my own thinking. You know, when you're out in the driveway at 3 o'clock in the morning, you have how many of you spend hours in your driveway after midnight? Probably not a whole lot of you, but that's my fate, as given my avocation. But I'll tell you what, there's something about looking up at the heavens, and you are connected in a unique way with the divine. Prayers are deeper, and I think answered in a unique way. But these are some thoughts that have occurred to me in the last several months. And before we look at these 6 points I want to go over with you quickly, I want to just share some recent images with you that I've taken. Here are my two telescopes. The one on the left is the observing telescope. It's an 18-inch reflector. The one on the right is my imaging scope, what I take all my pictures with. Here's a close-up of it, and you can see the complexity. It took me about 5 years to learn how to use this equipment, and I quit 100 times, but I was drawn back each time by the desire to image the creation, and I'm glad that I stuck with it. The mount here, this red mount you see on the bottom, that is was one of the several components I had to learn how to use. It is so complicated because it uses the same software as the largest observatories in the world, the behemoths on Mauna Kea, Hawaii, the Keck 10-meter telescopes, 33 feet in diameter. I mean, one of those mirrors would just about take up this whole room, and there's two of them now. They use the same software to control those telescopes that I use. The SALT telescope, the South Africa Large Telescope, the large telescope now in the Canary Islands, the very large array in Cerro Paranal, Chile, the high desert, all the major telescopes in the world use the same software that I use. The only difference is they used it once when they set up their telescope. I use it every night because I have to roll this thing out onto the driveway from the garage. My wife and I were in a restaurant recently, and I said, dear, look at these people. There's probably not anybody in this restaurant that realizes that in their midst is someone that could control any of the major telescopes in the world. She said, yeah, that's probably true. But the point is, what good is it? What am I going to do? Have a card with that on it? You can't make a living at it, believe me. But that's changing because I just received a check for $25 for an image that was published in the Reader's Gallery of Astronomy magazine, and it was this image right here. It doesn't do it justice here, but if you look in the magazine, it's pretty awesome picture. It's M29, an open star cluster, and that was featured in the March issue of Astronomy Magazine up here on the top, and I received a check for $25. So I'm beginning to pay for this equipment. Here's a picture, a recent picture I took of the globular star cluster M13. This is about 25,000 light years away. It's a globular cluster, like a bunch of stars that are compacted together like a snowball. You know, you look like it's pretty dense, but a rifle bullet going through the core of that cluster would only have a 1 in 100 billion chance of hitting a star. And you say, well, how's that possible? Because the stellar density, even in the core, is about 1,000 stars per cubic light year. So that turns out to be about a tenth of a light year separation. That's 150 times the distance from the sun to Pluto, for example. Even at that distance, if I could make this analogy, we're looking at basketballs separated by hundreds of miles, even in the densest part of that cluster. Compare that to the closest star beyond our sun, the Proxima Centauri in the Alpha Centauri system. It's 4.2 light years away. That's the near. Now, that's 40 times larger than what you see here. Yeah, there's a question.
People don't even believe that.
Yeah, isn't that right? What a great statement from Luke. Thank you very much. Even somebody had to make this, didn't they? There's a million stars there. Even a 10-year-old can understand that. But there's a lot of people with PhDs that don't, aren't there? And here's my picture on the left and the same image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope on the right. So you can see, despite the light pollution, the humidity, the low elevation, the fact that my telescope's 15 inches in diameter, the Hubble Space Telescope's almost 100, it's just amazing what the electronic revolution has done in astronomy, where rank amateurs in their gardens can take pictures rivaling the greatest telescopes on or above the Earth. And that's what makes it such an awesome hobby. I love it. I love being out there 2 or 3 in the morning. All my imaging is done after midnight. The atmosphere settles. It gets darker. Lights tend to go out. You have a full magnitude improvement in seeing conditions. And that's one of the secrets I have to apply. Here's a picture I took of the globular cluster, what's called the Intergalactic Wanderer. It's about 300,000 light years away. Our galaxy is only 125,000 light years in diameter. This is 300,000 light years away. So many astronomers for years thought that this was in the void of intergalactic space. I'm protecting you from photons. is that better? I'll just be here in the corner if you need me. Go back here. Now I can't even see what I'm showing you. Well, that's all right. So this was I can see it on that laptop over there, the Intergalactic Wanderer, it was called. Isn't that a great name? And so I took this picture just about a year ago, and I submitted it to astronomers. Here's, by the way, the same image taken by the Hubble Space Telescope. There's the Hubble Space Telescope. Here's my image. My image was, NASA picked it up January 23rd of 2009 as their astronomy picture of the day. Most of those pictures are taken by those Keck telescopes or the Hubble Space Telescope, occasionally an amateur, but it's kind of like winning the Nobel Prize to get a picture in the. Now, don't spoil it for the kids. And the Vatican Observatory has it in their 2010 calendar. I got a personal letter from the Holy Father. Send us more pictures. No, not really. This picture was taken by our son when he was on, just last May, when he was on a backpacking tour up and down Italy. He was in St. Peter's Square, and it just turned out that there was the Pope's weekly homily was about to begin, and the Pope in the Pope mobile passed right in front of him. He just pulled out his iPhone and snapped this picture and sent it to me. Here's my website. This presentation, if I say something worthwhile, we'll be on there later in the week. See the Glory. Isn't that a great name? Why do I name it that? Because Psalms 19:1 says, the heavens declare the glory of God. So what I'm doing is trying to see the glory. Okay, let's get into the heart of our session today. 6 reflections on astronomy and the Christian faith. How astronomy has informed me. You know, whatever your avocations are, they can inform your faith, can't they, Woody? ham radio, photography. There are parallels, there are analogies, there are metaphors that deepen and enrich our faith. And that, so many of us have found that to be true, and that is certainly true of astronomy. So let me share with you six things. I don't know if we'll get through all of these. Depends on how many questions I get from the peanut gallery up here. That's okay. I don't want to stifle questions. I encourage them. That's how you learn. Let's talk about the first one. These are not in any order. And that is the matter of eternity. Here is a picture of the Milan Cathedral in Italy. This is the second largest cathedral in the world. The second only to the Seville Cathedral. St. Peter's is technically not a cathedral. It's a basilica, so it doesn't count. But this church can comfortably seat 40,000 on the inside. And look at the artistry of the tile floor, for example. And in one corner of this sanctuary is a statue I want to draw your attention to. It's called Eternity Personified. And here we see Eternity Personified holding the Ouroboros, which is a Greek term, referring to this object down here that the statue is holding. You see this down here? It's kind of a circular item. It's actually a snake eating its tail. And that's an ancient symbol of eternity. It's death and regeneration, isn't it? You're eating your tail, and that is sustaining you for further life. So it's an eternal, the concept of eternity. The point is, eternity has been fundamental to Christian doctrine since the beginning of the church. Eternality, a related topic, is one of God's incommunicable attributes. Eternality refers to without beginning or end. We do not, that's incommunicable because we have a beginning, although we do not have an end. So it's not correct to talk about us as Christians using the term eternality, but rather eternity or eternal life or immortality. We see in John chapter 3, Jesus, just as Moses lifted up the snake in the desert, so the Son of Man must be lifted up, that everyone who believes in him may have eternal life. For God so loved the world that he gave his only Son, that whosoever believes in him should not perish, but have what? Eternal life. That's right. And so the point that's perplexed me, Roger, for many, many years is that concept of immortality, of endlessness. Does that mean we're going to stand and sing choruses forever? That's what I told my kids in a recent Sunday school class. You know, I looked at the stones of West Chapel when we used to be able to see them in the front of the church. And they confounded me. I would look at those stones every service, and I'd contemplate immortality. Just look at them, at stones and rocks. What do you think of? Immortality, endlessness, timelessness, imperishability, changelessness. What does that mean? What are we going to do forever? Look at it. People get it uneasy when the church service goes 15 minutes late. Compare that to eternity. My fourth grade class, we were talking about heaven before you were in the class. This was several years ago. And I asked the kids, I told the kids, heaven is, we're going to stand and sing choruses forever. They got kind of depressed. And one of the girls looked at me and said, is there shopping in heaven? And I said, no, there's no shopping in heaven. Another girl said, well, are there malls in heaven? I said, no, there's no malls in heaven. You're going to stand and sing choruses forever. And so it got real quiet for several seconds. And then one of the boys said, kind of with dejection, well, it's better than hell. Let me tell you something, class. It is better than hell. Do you believe that? It's an intellectual hothouse in there every week. Here is Dante's Divine Comedy. Have you ever read Dante's Divine Comedy? It's on my list of must reading, the 10 books that have most influenced my life and faith. The Inferno, Purgatorio, and Paradiso. Dante and Beatrice ascend the spheres of heaven, and they end up in paradise. The first few hours that they're there, Dante is lectured on theology by Thomas Aquinas. He's lectured on the history of the Roman Empire by Justinian. He's lectured on the problem of illegal immigration in Florence by his uncle. It is a place of intellectual stimulation and activity, not a place of beatific contemplation, not a place of standing and singing. In fact, if you read Milton's Paradise Lost, he talks about Mammon being one of the angels who was cast out of heaven, one of the third of the angels. And he says he had found it wearisome, warbling alleluias without end. So, you know, these things have informed me. What is heaven? What are we going to do for eternity? There's Dante and Beatrice in heaven. But anyway, here's the thing that changed everything for me not too long ago. And that was reading John Polkinghorne's Life of a Physicist. Polkinghorne, he's probably approaching 80 years of age now, but he taught at Cambridge University for a number of years theoretical physics. He was an cosmologist as well as a particle physicist, very instrumental in the discovery of the quark, one of the fundamental components, building blocks of the atomic structure. He, in the late 70s, he decided to resign his teaching position and become a priest. And so he attends seminary. He becomes ordained in 1982 as a Anglican priest. He leaves the school. He assumes a parish in a very poor area of Bristol, England, and labors there in obscurity for 5 years. And it was only then that he decides to return to the academic life. He comes back to Cambridge, where he was dean at Trinity Hall, a school where I've had the privilege of teaching. It's a school where Stephen Hawking is associated, the famous physicist with Lou Gehrig's disease. And after a few years there, he went and became the president of Queen's College at Cambridge, from which he retired in 1996. He's written several books integrating faith and science. They're powerful. I highly recommend anything written by John Polkinghorne. But here's this one quotation that has been so influential in my life. He says, "The life of heaven will involve the endless, dynamic exploration of the inexhaustible riches of the divine nature." Let me read that again. I've had a chance to ponder this. "The life of heaven will involve the endless, dynamic exploration of the inexhaustible riches of the divine nature." What is so profound about this statement is this, that he connects immortality, the concept that I've had problems with God's omnipotence and omniscience. Here's the point. If God is omnipotent and omniscient, as we know he is, it's going to take eternity for us to explore the inexhaustible riches of the divine nature. So linking eternity with omnipotence, to me, changed everything. And now I can look at those stones without distress. And it gives me great encouragement from John Polkinghorne. By the way, he's the founding member of the Society of Ordained Scientists. Okay, you ready for the next one? Let's go on. I hope that helps. Maybe you've never thought about eternity before, but it's interesting. The next concept that's really affected me is the concept not just of God's eternity, but of God's omnipresence. What does omnipresence mean?
Everywhere at the same time.
That's right. Everywhere at the same time. That's confounded me. There's some verses of Scripture that refer to God really in an anthropomorphic way. For example, in Exodus 24, God dines with the leaders of Israel. In Colossians, many verses in the New Testament, we find Christ seated where? At the right hand of God. So there are many verses of Scripture where we think of God being a singular presence in one spot. Well, how can he be omnipresent? How could he hear the prayer this morning in this class? I just walked up here this morning. I walked by a number of classes that were having prayer. Can he hear all those prayers? What about prayers going on in Africa, Asia, Iceland, Cuba? What about all those prayers? I don't want to offend those of you that are JFK fans, by the way. He pronounced it Cuber. And just those of you that lived in Massachusetts like I have, you know that you put an R on the end of any word that ends in a vowel. So it's not Cuba, it's Cuber. Okay? I just want to make that clarification. Got to be careful. Okay. So how can God be hearing prayers? Billions of prayers being launched right at this moment, simultaneously. Does that confound you? And yet, God is at the farthest reaches of the universe at the same time, holding everything together. How is this possible? You see what I'm saying? I've been perplexed by it. And yet, we know that there are verses of Scripture that say that God is everywhere. For example, in Psalms 130, "Where can I go from your spirit?" Psalms 139. Proverbs 15, the eyes of the Lord are everywhere, keeping watch on the wicked. It's one of the most important things I'll say, kids. Okay. Jeremiah 23, do not I fill heaven and earth? Matthew 18, for wherever two or three come together in my name, there am I with them. So we have verses that indicate God is everywhere. And yet he is in the farthest recesses of the universe, too, at the same time. So what does omnipresent mean? Is it the equivalent of pantheism? That's what I struggle with. Pantheism, which is a fundamental concept of many of the Eastern and New Age religions, Taoism, Hinduism, etc. Pantheism basically coming from two Greek words, pan meaning all, theism from the word for God, that God is all, that nature is God, and God is nature. There's no personal God. It's just a mystical force in the universe. Well, isn't that kind of what these verses indicate that we just looked at? Some of them? That's what I struggle with. And common responses of theologians have been, well, God is present in his glory and power. Or God is present through human conscience. Or God is present in the sense that he holds things together, according to Colossians 1. These are not satisfying answers, in my opinion. But a possible insight comes from science. This thought has just occurred to me in the last couple of months. The principle of quantum entanglement, what has been referred to by one science historian as perhaps the greatest mystery in physics. It comes from quantum mechanics, which is physics at the atomic level. There are some bizarre principles and rules that apply at that level. For example, the Heisenberg uncertainty principle, that we can never know the momentum or the velocity and the position of an electron simultaneously. The more accurately we know the one, the less accurately we know the other. And so it turns out that if there was a hydrogen atom in my hand, one proton and one electron, we would know the position of the electron only within a range of 10 feet, the quantum mechanical probabilistic distribution. Can you say that? He will by the end of the year, believe me. And so it's a matter of life, creation, reality is not a matter of reality. It's a matter of probability. You see me standing here, but how do you know I'm not doing jumping jacks on the platform of the church? It's kind of a weird concept. That's quantum mechanics. I knew of a physicist that said to his wife when he proposed, honey, I choose to marry you even though I am not certain of your existence. But the probability is sufficiently high that I'm willing to take that risk. Real romantic guy. Remember that for Valentine's Day. I give these flowers to you, not knowing for certain that you exist. Okay? But, question.
Is that friend you?
Oh, listen to her. Is that perceptive? Is that friend you? What a lot of you are thinking, she articulates. Okay. That's my secret. Okay. Let's move on. Let me talk about this principle of entanglement. It's absolutely unbelievable. And it dates back to the 1930s, but here's the idea, that two atomic particles that were entangled at the creation of the universe, and this can happen even subsequent to the creation, but if let's take a look at atomic particles, some of which were entangled, connected in a unique way at the creation of the universe, remain entangled forever. Now think about this. So that even though they fly off into different recesses of the universe and maybe 100 billion light years apart, one at one side, A, the other, B, at the other side of the universe. Einstein's theories of relativity say no information can be communicated faster than the speed of light. And here they are 100 billion light years. So it would take 100 billion years for one to know what the other's doing. And yet, when one of those entangled particles flips, the other flips instantly. There's no way to explain that. That's what Einstein called spukhafte Fernwirkung, which is Einstein himself, he called it spooky action at a distance. And he was never persuaded, really, with quantum mechanics in general, that it described reality, but certainly not the principle of entanglement. It is bizarre, isn't it? Now, but here's what one scientist says about it. See all the information, the binary code passing from one set of entangled particles to the other. That information is transferred instantly. Here's what one physicist says about this in his book entitled The God Effect, Quantum Entanglement, Science's Strangest Phenomenon. Entanglement is a strange feature of quantum physics, the science of the very small. It's possible to link together two quantum particles, photons of light or atoms, for example, in a special way that makes them effectively two parts of the same entity. You can then separate them as far as you like. A change in one is instantly reflected in the other. What happens with a pair of entangled electrons as you measure the spin of one? Until that moment, neither of them had a spin with a fixed value, but the instant you take the measurement on one, the other immediately fixes its spin, say to the opposite value. You know, I thought about this a lot in recent months, and here's the revelation. You know, a lot of theological concepts have their counterparts in the physical world. They're analogies in nature to theological concepts. Are you familiar with that? It's true. Is this principle of entanglement a metaphor for God's omnipresence? Now think about this with me for a minute. That God is, like it says here, somehow entangled with every particle, every part of his created universe. And he can interact with every one of us instantly, unlimited by time or distance. A million of us can be praying at the same time. It's no concern to an omnipotent God. He can still be in the farthest reaches of the universe because he's everywhere at the same time, because he's entangled with his creation. Now think about this. He hears your prayer. He feels your pain. He understands your struggles. He knows your thoughts. And he is connected with you in a most intimate way. Instantly. Make sense? And so in that sense, God is omnipresent. He is still anthropomorphic. Jesus can sit at his right hand. He can dine with the leaders of Israel. But he's at all times connected to every part of his creation. How dynamic, how satisfying to me. And that's the value of studying disciplines outside of your own. To get these perspectives, I tell my students at CBC and Evangel all the time, don't be in a cell, a prison of your own unique discipline. You should be, I had a friend that once read five disciplines outside of his own at any given time. He was reading five things. And I've tried that, and it's just too much for me. But I try to do two or three simultaneously. And, you know, cosmogony are two disciplines that are continuing disciplines, that because I draw so much inspiration and faith and understanding from those. Why should it be otherwise? The heavens declare the glory of God. Entanglement. God is connected with you, unlimited by time or distance, in a most intimate way. Let's talk about December 21, 2012. You know what that date's significant for? Now, I'm a student of Mayan calendrics, and I put this together last night for our presentation day, and there are just a few things I want to show you about this. The creation of the world took place on August 11th, 3114 BC, according to the Mayan calendar. Now, in Mayan chronology, one Catun is 7,200 days. They used multiples of 20 in much of their calendrics and math. One Baktun is 20 Catuns, or 144,000 days, which turns out to be 394.52 years. That's one Baktun, 394.52 days. Now, the end of the 13th Baktun from creation is 5,128.8 years. You do the math, you subtract that from the date of creation, 3114, and it turns out that the end of the 13th Baktun will take place on December 21st of the year 2012. The Mayan calendar, by the way, at that point, it doesn't, nothing indicates that it's the end of the universe. It just rolls over, just like the odometer on your car. You ever, we were there just recently in our car. It was about to roll over to 400,000 miles. No, it was something like 60,000. And so you see that 5999.7.8.9. It's kind of exciting, isn't it, to see that? So you drive off into a Walmart parking lot where you can kind of go slower and savor that experience. Drag it out and, you know, take a picture of it if you want. But there, all of a sudden, everything rolls over. That's what's happening in the Mayan calendar. It's rolling over. It's not, does that mean it's the end of your car? Well, it may if it's 400,000 miles. But not when you're at just the 13th baktun. It does not end. Here's where the confusion came. A book written in 1995, the Maya Cosmogenesis 2012. And this author predicted that on December 21st, 2012, the winter solstice, which is December 21, intersects, lines up with the galactic equator, which he believed signified the end of the former age, really the end of the world. That's when we're going to have the earthquakes, the tectonic plates erupting, volcanoes, and perhaps the very end of life on Earth, because this will be the end of that 13th baktun. Nothing in Mayan prophecy or literature indicates that that's going to happen. That's a conjecture, a speculation, a fanciful speculation by this one author who sold a lot of books with this speculation. And here's what it means. Sometime in 2012, the sun is going to be in the constellation Sagittarius. And, you know, the sun, because of precession, it's like a top that you wind up and put on a table. And as it slows down, what happens to it? Starts wobbling. That's called precession. Every 26,000 years, our Earth wobbles once. We are going to be lined up with the galactic equator in 2012. Now, he says it's going to be on the winter solstice. You can't be that precise. It's within about a 1,000-year error bar. But it's true. It's true that we are heading for that somewhat unique alignment of the galactic equator. That's basically the middle of our galaxy, the Milky Way, in Sagittarius. It occurs within a 1,900-year window, as I say. The Mayans themselves did not believe the end of Baktun 13 was the end of the world. You see prophecies, Mayan prophecies, that say, that talk about things happening in the 27th Baktun. Okay? An alignment of the galactic equator and the sun during a winter solstice has absolutely no physical effect on Earth. Compare the end of the world predictions over the last 50 years. Dozens of books have been written about how the world was going to come to an end. Have you seen some of these? Because of the alignment of the planets. They're all lined up. And think of the powerful gravitational pull that's going to result in the annihilation of life on this planet. Nonsense. Let's take a look at reality. The closest alignment that we will have for the next 700 years took place on May 5th, 2000. When the planets were lined up within about a 30-degree slice of pie in the sky. Now, it's never lined up one behind the other. That doesn't happen. But this was the closest thing to an alignment right here. And you see the planets that were in kind of a narrow wedge right here. It turned out it's about 25 to 30 degrees on May 5th, 2000. Did the world come to an end on that day?
No.
Did we see continents in collision? Did we see volcanoes happening everywhere? No. Nobody even knew it happened. And yet the gravitational effect of that alignment vastly exceeds any gravitational effect from the alignment with the galactic center on the winter solstice of 2012. For example, look at the gravitational effect of the planets on Earth compared to the moon. If the moon is a factor of one, then look at the biggest planet, Jupiter, which is 318 times more massive than the Earth, is only 1% of the gravitational pull of our moon. You could put all the planets together. They're still just barely above 1% of the gravitational attraction that we experience from the moon continuously. And so is the moon producing this kind of impact on us? No. And neither will a total alignment of the planets, even if that did occur, which it never will. And the gravitational impact of the galactic center is almost infinitely less than what you see here. So it's a fanciful theory that's not rooted in reality. Okay, now that brings us to the fourth thought that I want to share with you. And this is about what I call color and sound. If you're familiar with Wien's law from high school physics, named after Wilhelm Wien, German physicist, 1864 to 1928, who was responsible for a number of things, but in particular, Wien's law correlates color with temperature. And it makes sense, doesn't it? That the hotter matter becomes, the more energetic the atoms and the molecules are, and they emit radiation of a faster frequency and a shorter wavelength, which tends to the blue end of the visible spectrum, 400 nanometers, 400 billionths of a meter. Whereas as an object cools down, the atoms and the molecules become more sluggish, and the frequency is reduced and the wavelength is expanded toward the red side of the visible spectrum. You know, you're looking at maybe up to 700 nanometers or billionths of a meter. And so the point is, you can correlate color or wavelength with temperature. That's the key finding of this theory. So cooler matter tends to be toward red. In fact, if you look at a typical faucet combination, and Tim, you'll appreciate this, people have it exactly wrong. What is the blue dot on? It's on the cool. It should be on the what?
Hot.
Look at, even the kids understand this. See how I've messed them up? But Tim, you ever seen faucets that are right? With the blue is hot and the red is cool. Yeah, he's done it by accident. Okay, you did what was right without even knowing it. Well, what that means is the higher the temperature, the shorter the wavelength, basically. And by the way, do you know how to correlate Kelvin to Fahrenheit? Yeah. But to convert Kelvin degrees to Fahrenheit degrees, you take the Kelvin degrees times 9/5, and then you subtract 459.67, and that equals Fahrenheit. Just remember that. So, but here's the point. If you have a spectrophotometer that measures the intensity of photons from a light emitting source, you can actually correlate color with temperature, or temperature with color. And so we can tell the accurate color of an object by the intensity peak of the photons that it's emitting. And it turns out, if you look at the sun, for example, we're right here a little under 6,000 degrees Kelvin. Now, the human eye, let me say this, is a very imperfect, it's very imperfect at distinguishing colors. You know, I look at red and I see green. And, I mean, a fourth of all adult males have color blindness, so I have a real difficulty driving. And it's only with the utmost concentration that I'm able to obey traffic signals. But the point is that the sun, right there at 6,000 degrees Kelvin, is in the green section of the spectrum. So what is the true color of the sun?
Green.
Green. That's right. We've talked about that in our class, haven't we? The sun technically is green, but the human eye, it's an optical illusion, sees it as whitish yellow. But the true test of color is not what we think something is, but what does a photometer say that it is. You'll never see green. In my telescope, looking at millions of stars, you never see a green star, even though probably 8% of the stars in the universe are green, mostly in class F. You see this orange screen here? What color is that, Natalie?
Aqua blue, kind of.
Okay. It's actually pale turquoise. But anyway, the fact is, there were some astronomers last year that did photometric analysis of 200,000 galaxies. 200,000. This is a pretty decent representation. It was like a Gallup poll where they poll 600 people to tell what 300 million of us are thinking. And this was a representative sampling of galaxies. And what they found was radiation being emitted from all of these galaxies, if you averaged it, it would be pale turquoise. This is the dominant color of the universe. Isn't that impressive? So is that God's favorite color? Anybody here, is that your favorite color? Pale turquoise? Probably not. Oh, we have one. Okay. Kind of? It is now, right? My favorite is gray. Now, what about God's favorite sound? That's God's favorite color. What about God's favorite sound? I just want to share that last night, as I was preparing for this session, I came across some of my old band solos that I did in band competition, starting in grade school, starting in fourth grade. I was a drummer. Do you want to hear my solo? I just have a few seconds of it. My drum solo in fourth grade. You ready for this, Emily?
Yeah.
Listen. What are you laughing at? Wasn't that awesome? Okay. Now, here I was in sixth grade. Okay, you ready for this? This is my sixth grade. It was a love ballad, but I kind of spruced it up a little bit. Okay. Now, here I was in 10th grade. Here I was in 11th grade, one-handed. Okay, and here I was in my freshman year in college. Okay. Now, let me go back and explain what we're listening to here. In 1967, a graduate student at Cambridge University by the name of Jocelyn Bell, using a radio telescope, heard this, the Vela pulsar. And she mentioned it to her professor, advisor. They both concluded they were listening to signals from an intelligent civilization, and they must keep it a secret so the public wouldn't panic. Well, they kept listening with that radio telescope, and they found about 1,000 other signals like this, and they came to the conclusion it couldn't be intelligent signals. This has some physical basis, and in fact, it does. This is the crab pulsar, 30 times per second. This is another pulsar rotating at 174 times per second. 645, faster than a kitchen blender. What is 645 if you convert that to musical notation? B flat. And what are you listening to here? We're listening to pulsars, which are stars that started out 12 to 40 times bigger than our sun, but as they burn up their nuclear fuel, they begin to compress down and become more and more dense and compact until they're literally 6 to 10 miles in diameter, millions of times bigger than our Earth, condensed down into just 6 to 10 miles in diameter. And according to you've heard of the law of angular momentum, as you have mass, velocity, and distance have to be conserved. If one increases, one or both of the others must decrease. And in a neutron star, it is decreased in diameter so much that must be compensated for by an increase in either mass or speed. And since the mass is constant in these stars, the only way to conserve angular momentum is by increasing the velocity. And that's why you see these stars just fast spinners, hundreds and sometimes thousands of times per second. They are so dense that a tablespoon would weigh 1 billion tons. Here's a comparison of a neutron star with our sun. The sun rotates once a month. A neutron star maybe 1,000 times per second. The magnetic field is 1 trillion times more in a neutron star than our sun. The temperature significantly hotter. The diameter 6 to 12 versus 1 million miles. And the escape velocity 6 miles per second from Earth, half the speed of light from the surface of a neutron star. You're looking at 90,000 miles per second. Okay? Now, God's favorite sound. What would God's favorite sound be? Yes, question. Would God's favorite sound be prayer? I think that's probably, or praise or prayer. That's probably a good idea. It's a good point, Luke. But another idea would be this. A group of scientists, again, just last year, converted electromagnetic radiation in the universe to sound. And what they discovered was the prevalent sound in the universe today is B flat. They also discovered that the lowest ever detectable sound was a B flat 57 octaves below middle C. So there's some unique quality to B flat. It permeates the universe. And is that God's favorite note? I'll leave that to you for your consideration. Let's talk about the fifth idea, and that's the visible universe. You know, the universe is saturated with radiation coming from stars and galaxies and clouds of gas. And that radiation can take one of many, many different forms depending on its frequency and its wavelength. And only a tiny portion of that radiation actually penetrates through the Earth's atmosphere and reaches our surface. And that includes visible light, which is grossly overemphasized here in terms of the amount of radiation consisting of visible light. The gamma ray, which is the shortest wavelength and the highest frequency radiation, it has a wavelength at the atomic level. Literally, you're looking at the width of an atom. That's the wavelength for gamma radiation. It's ionizing. It changes molecular structure. So does X-rays. That's why we have to be careful about how much we are exposed to. The non-ionizing radiation over on the right-hand side, it's not, the verdict's still out as to whether that causes molecular damage, like cell phones at your ear for hours every day. But visible light comes down through the atmosphere to the surface of the Earth. But visible light, what we see, the spectrum, red, orange, yellow, green, blue, indigo, violet, that is only a tiny section of the whole radiation spectrum. By the way, the longest range radio waves are up to 19 million miles from wavelength to wavelength, crest to crest. For visible light, the only light we see with our eyes is between 400 and 700 nanometers, which is between 400 and 700 billionths of an inch, and those are all the wavelengths that we see as colors. And that corresponds to about 1/100th the width of a piece of paper. Now think about that. One sheet of copy paper is 100 times thicker than all the wavelengths that the human eye can see in a spectrum of radiation that spans almost 20 million miles. What does that mean? Our eyes only see wavelengths 1/100th the width of a piece of paper in a spectrum millions of miles wide. We see 1/10 quadrillionth of a percent of the entire spectrum. We see nothing. We're effectively blind to the vast majority of what is taking place in the universe. But here's the amazing thing. Despite that fact, the peak intensity level of virtually every star and galaxy in the universe, 10 to the 22nd power of stars, that's what, 100 billion trillion stars in the universe. All of those stars peak in those wavelengths that the human eye can see. And so we see them. What if they were a billionth of an inch to one side or the other of that spectrum? The tiniest difference, one side or the other of that spectrum, and what would we see? Nothing. We wouldn't even see the sun. We wouldn't see the moon. We wouldn't see the stars. We would see a black void above us with no knowledge. And what is the spiritual or scriptural significance of this? Psalms 19:1 declares, the heavens declare the glory of God. Would that be true if the radiation coming from the heavens was the slightest bit manipulated, down to a billionth of an inch? We would see nothing. But it turns out that everything in the universe is at the very precise point that fits within that tiny window of 1/100th of the width of a piece of paper in order for our photon detectors, our eyes, to see it. To me, that is just absolutely an incredible fact of nature. Let me mention a sixth idea, and that is the concept of linguistics. Linguistics has to do with language. Some of you are familiar with Ludwig Wittgenstein. Some would say probably one of the great philosophers of the 20th century. He wrote, many consider the greatest philosophical work of the 20th century, the Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. It consists essentially of seven sentences. Wittgenstein believed that language, and I quibble with this, is the only means of transmitting thoughts and ideas. Do you have a dog, Natalie?
No.
Emily?
I do.
You have a dog? Can you tell if the dog is happy?
Sort of, whenever it wags its tail.
Yeah, it wags its tail. How about you,
Barbara? I can tell whenever she is, like, all excited.
Yeah, you can tell when your dog's excited, Gracie. And so, you know, I don't know that language is the only mechanism for transmitting thoughts and ideas, but that's what Wittgenstein said. And the point is this. There are limitations on language, the ability of language to transmit ideas. It's interesting that Psalms 19:1 says that the heavens declare the glory of God, not with words, but the heavens themselves, their existence, their revelation, declares the glory of God. And right here we see, kind of similar to Wittgenstein, well, maybe in contradiction to Wittgenstein, that God's nature speaks to us. What was it the gates of hell say to Dante in the Inferno? Justice moved our high maker. The people that are there because of divine justice, aren't they? Which we deserve too, don't we? Let's talk about Aquinas and the Summa. You know, Thomas Aquinas, one of the great theologians in the history of the church, writing in the 13th century, he was writing the Summa Theologica, his great work integrating reason and revelation. And something happened to him at a worship service he attended on December 6, 1273. He had a direct encounter with God. We don't know exactly what happened because he never described it, but he never writes another word. He doesn't finish his magnum opus. Other colleagues urged him to do so, but he said that, "I can do no more. Such things have been revealed to me that all I have written seems as straw, and I now await the end of my life." He dies a few years later, nobody ever knowing what exactly he encountered other than the presence of God somehow. And so here's this guy that spent 9 million words seeking to reconcile faith and reason, to reconcile, to describe the Christian experience. And when he comes in contact with God, he finds words are inadequate to describe. And then you have Dante in the Divine Comedy, when he goes with Beatrice to Paradiso. And as they climb the circles of heaven, he says that everything becomes more beautiful and the music more transcendent the closer they approach the throne of God. And when he gets to the throne of God and he stands facing God, face to face, all he can do is say, and if I can, I'll use the medieval Italian here, "Alta fontesa che manco possa." At this high place, the experience exceeded my capacity to describe. Think about that. At this high place, the experience exceeded my capacity to describe or explain. It's beyond words, isn't it? Some things that we've all experienced in our lives. How could it be otherwise? When we look at the heavens and the glory of God, we, like Dante and Aquinas, are speechless because words cannot communicate the experience that we have. Now, the seventh point I want to mention. The heavens, I was going to just leave it at six, but since we have some extra time, I thought I'd add a couple other ideas for you that have helped to shape and inspire my own faith. And the seventh one is this. Again, it's a takeoff on Psalms 19:1, that the heavens declare the glory of God. Well, what are the heavens? We've come to know what the word heavens means in the last century in a way that would have been incomprehensible just 200 years ago to the best scientist in the world. And the first point I want to make is about the nature of the nebulae, or what is called the spiral nebulae. One of the greatest mysteries in the history of science, the nature of these nebulae. The word nebulae is a plural of nebula, which is a Latin noun meaning cloud. And the fact is, with a telescope of any reasonable size aperture, when you look up at the sky, it looks something like this. This is a picture I took of the Virgo cluster, 60 million light years away, containing thousands of galaxies. It is the direction in which our galaxy is being gravitationally drawn. That's our destiny. Thousands of galaxies there. I've seen as many as 20 galaxies in the same field of view in the eyepiece of my telescope. 200 if I take a one-second image with a CCD camera. But the point was, you know, with the invention of the telescope, as the sizes of telescopes got progressively larger, astronomers began to see these little clouds. I mean, isn't that a good name? Nebulae? They look like little clouds, don't they? What are those clouds? And there was a debate as to what those were. Were they just little clouds of hydrogen gas in our Milky Way galaxy, which is the only galaxy in the universe? Or are they separate galaxies like our own, separated from us by unimaginable distances, containing countless stars? And that was the debate that raged. And as we began to use photography, starting at the dawn of the 20th century, scientists began seeing more and more of these nebulae. Back in 1755, Immanuel Kant proposed that the nebulae are separate islands, of countless stars. And then the 1780s to the 1820s, the British astronomer William Herschel discovered thousands of these nebulae in his new general catalog of astronomical objects, of which there are about 8,000 in total. Half of them he discovers. Most of those were these nebulae. And then in 1847, William Parsons, an Irish astronomer, builds the largest telescope in the world that was called the Leviathan of Parsonstown until 1917, when the Hooker telescope on Mount Wilson was fabricated. His major objective in building this telescope was to resolve the nebular hypothesis. What are these nebulae that were seen? He's the first person to observe spiral structure in these nebulae because of the size of the mirror. He used speculum rather than glass, and it tarnished quickly in the humidity. And so he had to have a second mirror that he always had one in the shop that he was repolishing and one on the instrument itself. 1920, there was one of the most famous debates in the history of science on the scale of the universe by the nature of the spiral nebulae. Are they clouds in our galaxy, or are they separate galaxies outside of our own? And you had Harlow Shapley argued that our galaxy is the only galaxy in the universe, and those numerous spiral nebulae are gas clouds in our galaxy. Harlow Shapley was born in Nashville, Missouri, just north of Joplin in a dirt floor shack, and became probably the second greatest astronomer of the 20th century. The other participant in the debate was Heber Curtis, son of a Presbyterian pastor, had memorized most of the New Testament, by the way. He argued that our galaxy is but one of countless galaxies, and those nebulae are, in fact, other galaxies. That debate was summarized in the Journal of the Royal Astronomical Society of Canada. So as recently as 1920, just 90 years ago, we had no idea of the true nature of the universe, which to me is just absolutely amazing. The heavens declare the glory of God. Well, what is that glory? What are the heavens telling us? We were so limited in our understanding just 90 years ago. And everything changes when Edwin Hubble begins to examine the galaxy M31. This is one of those spiral nebulae with the great Hooker telescope at Mount Wilson, which came online in 1917, 1918. It was 100 inches in diameter, was the largest telescope in the world. It was made of glass, the mirror, so it was high quality, not like the Leviathan. And some of the early pictures taken, you can tell by looking at that photograph at the dawn of the 20th century. It's hard to tell what that is, isn't it? Is that a cloud of gas, or is that billions of stars? You can't tell. Here's my first picture I took of it several years ago. You can't tell what it is. Here's a picture I took just last year of it. But even with that much greater clarity and resolution, you still can't tell if that's a gas cloud or billions of stars. Why? It's 3 million light years away. That's 20 quintillion miles. That's 20 followed by 18 zeros miles away. No wonder we can't tell what the difference is. Here's another picture I took of that. But again, you can't tell. Here's a close-up picture I took. Now, I can count over 20 globular star clusters in that picture, which is pretty awesome, being 3 million light years away. But I still can't resolve individual stars. 1917, using that 100-inch Hooker telescope at Mount Wilson, Edwin Hubble resolves for the first time stars in the Andromeda Galaxy M31 and determines that those spiral nebulae, those countless nebulae that are showing up on our photographic plates are nothing less than other galaxies at unimaginable distances from our own. There's Mount Wilson, and there I am standing by the Hooker telescope a couple years ago on a visit there. You can see in the upper corner there the chair that Hubble, in fact, used to make his groundbreaking discoveries. So now we can look at these photographic plates, or we can look at it through a telescope, at these countless spiral nebulae, and now we know what they are. They're not little wisps of cloud in the one galaxy that exists in the universe. A very truncated view of God's glory, isn't it? But rather, these are virtually a menagerie of galaxies, countless galaxies, each of which with tens, if not hundreds, of billions of stars separated by us by vast distances. The universe is huge, and it's populated by any number of celestial objects, and a much more expansive conception of God's power and glory. Psalms 19:1, the heavens declare the glory of God. You follow what I'm saying here? We're beginning to comprehend, to apprehend better a sense of what that means. Hubble confirmed the true nature of the nebulae by resolving those individual stars. By the way, Edwin Hubble was an interesting guy. He's the most famous astronomer of the 20th century. Harlow Shapley, the second most famous. Shapley, born in Nashville, Missouri. Does anybody know where that is? Just north of Joplin. Edwin Hubble, born in the 1880s in Marshfield, Missouri. The greatest astronomer of the 20th century. He lived in Marshfield for a few years, and the family moves to Wheaton, Illinois. He was more of an athlete than he was a scholar. In fact, he particularly did not do well in spelling. So the thing about him was he was very athletic. He played on the high school basketball team, and he actually had the state of Illinois high school high jump record for many years. When he went to the University of Chicago, studied astronomy, he was a star forward on the basketball team. And in 1908 and 1909, the team won the Big Ten championship with Shapley as their leading player. The basketball they used in that championship game in 1909 was on display at the university. And a shuttle mission 2 years ago to repair the Hubble telescope, NASA decided to send that basketball up as well. Well, that created a problem because in space without an atmosphere, that basketball would explode. And so they had to deflate it somehow. Well, they sent it to the physics department at the University of Chicago, and they discovered it didn't have a valve on it. They were bewildered at how the thing was inflated. We can't deflate it either. They spent days examining this and trying to figure it out, and finally they decided to make an incision and let the air out. And so the deflated basketball accompanied the astronauts on the space shuttle to repair the Hubble Space Telescope. Just a little trivia for you. So really, it's interesting that it has been said that Hubble literally discovered the universe, discovering the nature of the universe. But he discovered something else about the universe that is very significant. And that's the eighth point I want to share in closing. And that is the expanding. He discovered that the universe is not just filled, a menagerie of galaxies. He also discovers that this universe is expanding. Totally unpredicted. Nobody had ever conceived of such a thing. And this story starts back in 1896 with Percival Lowell, a philanthropist, industrialist, builds an observatory in Arizona, Flagstaff, Arizona, which is still there, with a 24-inch refractor telescope. There he is sitting there observing with it. His obsession was finding life on Mars and, in general, finding life in the universe. He drew these fanciful maps of the surface of Mars that he was seeing, with canals separating the polar caps, with the arid equatorial regions to enable the Martians to farm. That was widely believed 100 years ago. He believes the spiral nebulae were new solar systems being formed. So he has his young assistant, Vesto Slipher, down here in the bottom left, to obtain spectra using a spectroscope or prism for several spiral nebulae to show their composition. Because the spectra that you take of a light-emitting object tells us the composition of that object. And so Slipher examines thousands of galaxies. He detects huge redshifts in the spectra of these spiral nebulae in 1914. And why was that? And this is what he was seeing. Here's a typical what's called an absorption spectrum of our sun. And the lines there indicate what the composition of the sun is. Now, you look at the star on the bottom that's in it's actually a galaxy a billion light years away that's moving away from us. You see basically the same lines there, but you look at how they're shifted to the right, to the red end. You see that? That's called a red shift, and that's essentially the Doppler effect. You ever notice when a train is coming in your direction and you're the first one in line there at the train tracks, what happens to the frequency or pitch of that whistle, or that horn? It goes up, doesn't it, as it's approaching you. And as it passes you and goes in the other direction, what happens? It goes down. It's because the wavelength is being compressed as it's coming to you, higher frequency. And as it goes past you, the wavelength spread out and the frequency drops. And so the note that you hear drops. Well, the same thing happens with radiation as with sound. Any wave exhibits this characteristic. This is what Hubble deduces. that what all these absorption lines with the redshifts that Slipher was finding in 1914, he had no idea what it meant. The solution to this enigma we can attribute to this gentleman right here, Milton Humason, who was a third grade dropout. Don't get any ideas. Don't think you're going to be a great scientist if you drop out of school in fourth grade. Okay, highly unlikely. But he does. He drops out of school in third grade, and he becomes a mule train driver in California. And his job was taking pack trains of mules up Mount Wilson to the observatory up there so the astronomers had food. And then he'd bring the mules back down to base camp. Well, he did this many, many times, and he meets the observatory electrician's daughter. They fall in love. He wants to marry her. He seeks the permission of the electrician. He couldn't bring himself to let his daughter, his one and only daughter, marry this mule train driver with a third grade education. So he wanted something better for her. He gets him a job as a janitor there at the observatory. And so he thought that was a sufficient increase in stature that he gave his permission for his daughter to get married. So they get married. Humason, as doing his work cleaning up the observatory, he comes across these photographic plates, these big glass plates of galaxies that Hubble had been taking. And he begins examining these things. He discovers that the redshifts of those galaxies that Slipher had discovered were directly related to the distance of those objects or their speed, the farthest objects or the fastest objects. And Humason and Hubble together come up with what they call the distant velocity relationship, that the farthest galaxies have the biggest redshifts because they're moving the fastest away from us, and they're the farthest away. There's only one explanation for this. The universe is expanding. And that's what these two guys discover. One of the most significant discoveries in human history. In 1931, Hubble publishes probably the seminal article in the history of astronomy in the Astrophysical Journal, the velocity-distance relation among extragalactic nebulae. And he includes Humason as a co-author, this third-grade dropout, one of the great acts of magnanimity in the history of science. He was willing to endure the shame of being associated with this guy who had become a friend because he was integrally involved in this discovery. So now we look up at the universe and we see these galaxies. We know what they are, thanks to Edwin Hubble. And we know that the universe is expanding. These little nebulae are massive islands of billions of suns at unimaginable distances. They're flying away from us at enormous speeds in an expanding universe that will never contract. The glory of God becomes more incredible and indescribable the more we learn. Language becomes an inadequate means of describing the glory of God. We should not be surprised, for we, like Aquinas and Dante, are beholding the very glory of God. Oh, by the way, Lucas, do you know what a light year is?
The distance light travels in a year.
How many miles?
6 trillion.
That's exactly right.
Light years. Is there anything faster now, as the scientists ever found anything faster than light year to measure distance?
Absolutely. And keep in mind, the concept of a light year is meaningless outside of our planet. You know, because it's the speed of light. Okay, the speed of light. Yes, Einstein's special theory of relativity said there are three exceptions to the speed of light being the maximum speed. One of them is particles that were going faster than the speed of light at the creation of the universe. One of them is the cosmological constant, the fact that our universe is expanding at an accelerating rate, and so the speed of light is the same, but it's in a frame of reference. The farther you go, the faster space and time is moving, and it has the effect of exceeding the speed of light. In fact, it's estimated that within a billion years, we'll see maybe only one galaxy in the heavens. It's just like an expanding balloon, the polka dots on the surface. Everything's going to be so much farther away from everything else. And even now, there are galaxies at the edge of the universe that we no longer can see. They're blinking out because of time is the speed of light is being exceeded.
I've heard that they tried, or the reasoning for all this expanse and research.
Well, one of the Gary, one of the holy grails is finding life on other planets. Because if we find life, and by the way, over 500 planets have been discovered now beyond our solar system, and the number is mounting continuously. And now with the Kepler satellite that just went up, it's going to be able to find Earth-sized planets. And the hope is that you can examine the atmosphere of some of these planets and detect methane or certain other gases that would indicate life or carbon dioxide. And the whole point is this, that if we discover such a planet, and if we discover that life exists on one of those planets, what does that do? Ha! There is no God. Christianity is wrong after all, and we've proven it. Because life can come about through spontaneous means and then through evolution, voila, it creates intelligent life. It's happened here, and now we're finding it all through the galaxy. So it's the scientist holy grail of disproving Christianity or theism in general. And that's a big part of the motivation of these searches. Think about it. Like one famous scientist said, are we alone in the universe or is the universe teeming with life? Either conclusion is mind-boggling. And that's true. We've talked about that in this class before. When I've given my view that intelligent, in fact, any life is unique in the universe to this planet, except for probably Mars, because life is so prolific here, it inevitably has migrated to Mars from Earth, not because it came from Mars to Earth.
So it's not true science, and if they start out with a presupposition. Mm-hmm.
And they're seeking to prove it.
And they're seeking to prove
it. It's not the scientific method. But you know what? They haven't done it. We've been doing increasingly sensitive radio searches for the last 40 years now. And looking for multi-frequency scanners, looking at millions of frequencies, Woody, simultaneously, looking for, and they have a whole set of parameters where they would indicate what if this is an intelligent signal, nothing. And you're looking at millions and millions of stars that are subsumed in these studies. And I'll tell you what, it's a very discouraging thing. But these guys get up every day and go back to the radio telescopes, and today may be the day, just like that treasure hunter down in Florida. Mel Fisher, you may have remembered, he found the Atocha wreck, sunk in the 1630s, a Spanish galleon loaded with billions of dollars in gold. And for 25 years, he and his wife and family would go out in their ship looking. 25 years. Every morning he'd get up and say, today may be the day. It was his indomitable encouragement and faith in what he was going to find that sustained his family when years before they wanted to quit. And that's the way radio astronomy is today. Today may be the day, as depressing as the statistics seem. If life was teeming in the universe, we'd have connected by now.
Can we look? I don't know. I need a recommended reading list here. I need books.
Just my verbal presentations. Must sustain you.
No, it won't.
My wife listens to these every day. She loves them. No, I'm just kidding. I do. I listen to them in the car. I've got dozens of these presentations on my website. But let me just say this in conclusion. Things are changing. It's kids like this that go to district camp. And you know what? Maybe they feel like they're called into ministry, but that's not the pastoral ministry. Maybe it's God's calling me to be a physicist, a particle physicist, or an astronomer, that I can help change people's minds, that there is a God, and direct their research along theistic lines. I see evidence of that happening with greater acceleration all the time. But it comes down to this, to the will. There are people that will not. But look at when Lazarus, when he was raised from the dead, not everybody believed. The Pharisees didn't believe. They would watch Jesus perform miracles. It didn't persuade them because it didn't match their template. And so your mind, your will can shut the door on open investigation. And that's what's happening with these scientists. They're closed-minded, they're parochial, and they refuse to even consider the mounting evidence for divine design. And so be it. That's their decision, isn't it? They get to make that decision unfettered by the God with whom they are entangled.